Mr. Weaver, you have a prepared statement that will be made a part of the record fully, and you are invited to proceed as you choose and to take your time. And as noted, we have a mock-up of the Ruby Creek area. We have the door of your house, so to the extent you find it convenient, appropriate to make references to that physical evidence, you may do so.
Thank you, sir. Chairman Spector and honored senators, I'd like to introduce you to my daughter, Sarah.
Thank you.
Two of my daughters are back home. Two of my family members are dead, my son Samuel and my beloved wife, Vicki. On August 21st, 1992, federal marshals shot my son Samuel in the back and killed him. He was running home to me. His last words were, "I'm coming, Dad." They shot his little arm almost off, and they killed him by shooting him in the back with a 9mm submachine gun. The gun had a silencer on it. He was not wanted for any crime. He did not commit any crime. The marshals killed his dog right at his feet. He only tried to defend himself and his dog. Sam was just 14 years old. He did not yet weigh 80 pounds. He was not yet 5 feet tall. The marshals who killed Sammy were grown men. They were in combat gear. They had their faces painted with camouflage. They were wearing full camouflage suits with black ninja-type hoods. They were carrying machine guns and large caliber semi-automatic pistols. They were trained to kill. Two of them were hiding behind trees and rocks in the woods where they couldn't be seen. The third was around a bend in the trail in thick forest. They were under direct orders from Washington to do nothing to injure the children. They were to have no contact or confrontation with me or my family. They killed him anyway in violation of their orders. On August 22, 1992, completely without warning of any kind, an FBI sniper shot and killed my wife, Vicki. He was using a 308 caliber sniper rifle with a specially weighted barrel and a 10 power scope. He was using match grade ammunition. He had years of training to kill. I heard him testify at trial that he wanted to kill. He shot.
He took the baby from her as she lay dead and bleeding on her kitchen floor.
Take whatever time you need, Mr. Weaver.
Thank you. Now, I'm not without fault in this matter. I was convicted of failure to appear for trial on charges I had sold a sawed-off shotgun to an ATF informant named Gus Magisano. He testified at trial under a different name, Kenneth Fadley. That was probably not his real name either. I was found not guilty of the original weapons charge, and I was found not guilty of every other crime I was charged with, including murder and assault on federal officers. I was charged with conspiring against the government, and I was found not guilty of that charge. I was in jail for about a year before and during the trial. I have served time after the trial and am now on supervised probation. I faced my accusers at a trial. I faced the FBI, the Marshal Service, the United States Attorney, a federal judge, and a jury of my peers. I faced the death penalty. I've been accountable for my actions. I now face you, senators, to ask that those responsible for the killings of my wife and my son be brought to account for their actions. If I had it to do over again, knowing what I know now, I would make different choices. I'd come down from the mountain for the court appearance. I would not have allowed a deceitful, lying con man working for ATF to push me for almost 3 years to make a sawed-off shotgun for him. I would not allow myself to be tempted in a weak moment when my family needed money. I would not let my fears and the fears of my family keep me from coming down. But my wrongs did not cause federal agents to commit crimes. Nothing I did caused federal agents to violate the Constitution of the United States. I did not cause federal agents to violate the oath of their office. my actions did not cause federal agents to violate direct orders from Washington. My choices did not cause federal agents to violate state and federal law. My behavior did not cause federal agents to violate their own agency policies. Federal agents have admitted to illegal acts. Judge Free, the head of the FBI, has made statements to the press that the so-called rules of engagement were unconstitutional. Federal agents have tried to cover up their illegal actions. That was their choice, not mine. I have been accountable for my choices. They should be held accountable for their wrongs. But no federal agent has been brought to justice for the killings of Sam and Vicki Weaver. In fact, agents of the FBI have been part of the cover-up of what really happened. One, after flunking a lie detector test, has admitted shredding documents that might clear up who authorized the death warrants on my family. I feel I have a right to know. Whether it was officials of the FBI or Department of Justice, the citizens should know who gave the shoot on site orders and who approved them. The Department of Justice has covered up what really happened by delaying, even now, the official release of two 500-page reports concerning the conduct of federal agents at Ruby Ridge. What we know about those reports was leaked to the media, but even as we speak, Attorney General Reno and the Department of Justice have still not officially released a single in-depth report about FBI and Marshal Service conduct. The cover-up has its roots in Ruby Ridge, where federal agents lied by telling Washington officials that the Weavers had ambushed federal marshals and had pinned the marshals down by firing hundreds of rounds at them. According to their own testimony at my trial, it was the marshals who were in camouflage, hiding in the trees when my boy came walking down the trail following his dog. The FBI testified of numerous grid searches of the Y using metal detectors and even using a person who was supposed to have powers as a dowser to find bullets with a forked stick. In all of their many searches, they found only 19 rounds fired, three by Kevin Harris, two by Sam, for a total of five by the boys, one by Marshall Roderick, six by Marshall Cooper, and seven by Marshall Deegan, making 14 fired by the marshals. Murray Cooper continued the cover-up by testifying at my trial that the first shot was fired by Kevin Harris. He claimed Kevin killed Marshall Deegan with a .30-06. Marshal Frank Norris, who was further up the mountain on that day, testified that the first shots were the distinctive sound of .223, not a .30-06. Cooper testified that Mr. Deegan fell over as he was shot and never got up again. That testimony was false. Evidence showed that Marshal Deegan traveled over 22 feet, firing his weapon seven times before he was killed. The cover-up continued during the trial. My lawyers sought records of the FBI investigation of Lon Horiuchi's shooting of my wife and myself and Kevin Harris. They sought the records long before the trial began and continued requesting them during the trial. The FBI and the U.S. Attorney did not furnish the records until after Horiuchi's testimony was completed and he had returned to Washington. Among the papers given to us late was a drawing made by Horiuchi showing that he could see people behind the door when he shot my wife. Judge Lodge was outraged and ordered that Horiuchi return for further cross-examination. In a rare move, he also ordered the government to pay a fine for their conduct in delaying disclosure of that information. Lon Horiuchi, the FBI sniper who killed my wife, said in a statement given to FBI officials on September 1, 1992, 10 days after he killed my wife, that he went through the rules of engagement in his mind just before the shooting. He decided to shoot to kill because Kevin Harris had a weapon in the vicinity of the cabin. He decided to neutralize Kevin, but the crosshairs of his sight were on the window of the door where my wife was standing. No other sniper fired. To my knowledge, Lon Horiuchi has never been disciplined in any way for killing my wife. Some say that all this could have been avoided if I had simply come down from the mountain and gone to trial. When I chose not to come down, I knew that I would be set up at court just as I had been set up by the ATF. In fact, the ATF spy appeared at trial and admitted to 31 lies while he was on the stand. It admitted that he was going to get a monetary settlement from ATF if I were convicted, but he would not get paid if I was acquitted. I was told in my arraignment by Stephen Ayers, a federal magistrate, that I would probably have to forfeit a $10,000 bond if I lost my case. He said it was to pay the government back for the cost of my court-appointed attorney. That meant that if I were convicted, my family would be left destitute, penniless, and homeless. The only asset we had to pay such a debt was our home on Ruby Ridge. Judge Ayers admitted at my trial that he misstated the law to me. There really was no law that I had to pay the government back for my lawyer if I lost my case. When the ATF officers arrested me for selling the shotgun, they did so by pretending to be a family with car trouble. They knew I was the kind of person who would try to help someone in trouble. It was a cold and snowy day. They were stopped on a bridge. When I walked up to try to help, several agents jumped me and threw me to the ground. A female agent posing to be the stranded wife threw Vicky to the ground with her face in the snow. Vicky had done nothing wrong. Court officers confused me about the court dates. I was first told my court date would be February 19th, 1991. The judge later changed that to February 20th because he did not want court staff to have to travel on a holiday. Another court official named Carl Richens, a probation officer, wrote me on February 7th and told me that my court date was on March 20th. And I did not appear on February 19th, an article appeared in a local paper quoting Chief Probation Officer Hummel saying that no letter had been sent telling me of the March 20th court date. I provided the senators a copy of the letter telling me the court date was on March 20th. Even though they understood my confusion and mistrust of the court system, including the mix-up over the court date, Deputy U.S. Attorney Ron Hoehn obtained an indictment charging me with failure to appear, and a federal judge issued a warrant for my arrest. There was testimony at my trial that Mr. Hoehn obtained the indictment knowing that he would most likely have to dismiss the case because of the confusion caused by the Richens letter. Hoehn admitted that to the marshals, who wrote it out in a memo. The Marshal Service requested that they be allowed to contact me and try to clear up the confusion before any warrant had to be served. Both the judge and Mr. Hoehn refused. I wanted reassurance that I would get a fair trial without all the deception and trickery. I wanted to know that the government was not going to take away my home, leaving Vicky and my children homeless. I needed to know that the government would not take our children away from Vicky if I were sent to jail. I needed to know that my wife and my children were not going to be prosecuted for any crimes. At my trial, I learned from the testimony of Marshal David Hunt that he wanted to give me assurances on all those points, but was prevented from doing so by Mr. Hoehn. Mr. Hoehn told him in a letter dated October 17, 1991, that Marshal Hunt could not discuss these issues with me and that these issues were not proper to address unless I agreed to plead guilty to the charges. Because of our confusion and fear and mistrust, my family made a decision that I would not come down. That decision brought the marshals to my home on the mountain on August 21, 1992. But that decision did not caused the marshal to kill my son and the FBI to kill my wife. That decision did not cause federal agents to lie and cover up what they had done, leading to further tragedy. That decision did not cause the FBI to send snipers to the mountain with orders to kill my family and to shoot them on sight without investigating what had happened the previous day. When the sniper killed my wife, he had not witnessed anyone in my family commit a crime. No sniper or FBI agent on the mountain had witnessed any of my family commit a crime. No FBI agent had even talked with the marshals that had been involved in the shooting the previous day. The FBI sniper was executing suspects and witnesses. The FBI sniper was judge, jury, and executioner. I'm here today to do all my power to avoid such tragedies in the future. I want the citizens of this country to learn from our tragedy so that no one else will have to suffer as my girls and I have had to suffer. I am here today to do all my power to see that all citizens, including law enforcement officers, obey the law. I'm here today because there must be accountability for the killings of my wife and son. When high-ranking FBI officials issue death warrants and cover up their involvement, the message they send to police officers all over the country is, it is okay if you can get away with it. Citizens who cannot trust their government band together in fear. If people in positions of power commit unlawful acts and are not held accountable, then the citizens' fear of the government is justified. I ask you to uncover the truth about the federal agents who have committed wrongs. I ask you to bring them to account before you. I ask you to see to it that those persons who killed my wife and my little 14-year-old son are brought to justice. I ask it for me, I ask it for my family, and I ask it for my country.
Thank you very much, Mr. Weaver.
Thank you.
Mr. Weaver, you have been consistently referred to as a white separatist. When we met back on May 13th this year, I asked you what that reference meant to the best of your knowledge, and I think it is an appropriate starting point for a response today. Were you a white separatist, and what does that mean as you understand it?
Well, sir,
it's okay. Yeah.
Chairman, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, what to me separatist means is a couple different things. Number one, I'm not a hateful racist, the way most people understand that, but I believe in that if there's separation of races, scripturally speaking, that's what I believe is right. It sounds like an impossible task, and most likely is, but I believe that every people of every race should be proud of who they are and what they are. There are good people in every race. There are bad people in every race. And as I have to say that as far as this meeting today is concerned, I am almost totally, emotionally overwhelmed that it's even taken place. And another thing about separation is when we moved from Iowa to Idaho, we wanted to separate into a remote area to give the children a good area to grow up, and we had had beliefs that, you know, if there ever was a natural disaster or downfall of the government or whatever, we wanted to be separated from the rest of the world. We did not want to be a part of it. Survival, you might call it. We wanted to separate out and be able to survive, you know, any bad times ahead, if there were going to be.
Beyond that being your own personal view, did you ever take any specific action? Not that you aren't entitled to take lawful action, but did you ever take any action to try to implement those views, aside from holding those views as your own personal belief?
Never.
Now, there has been considerable reference made to the Aryan Nations as a possible basis for the action from the Alcohol, Firearm, and Tobacco Unit. Would you tell the subcommittee what contacts, if any, you ever had with the organization known as the Aryan Nations, and start, if you would, by describing what you understood the organization Aryan Nations to be with respect to its purpose?
To this day, I'm not sure what their total purpose is. I had been to Aryan Nations three, maybe four times over a four-year period, and I was originally invited to go down there by some guy that had claimed to be a friend of mine, and I found out later he wasn't. But
when you say to go down there, what do you mean by that?
To go down to Aryan Nations to they have a yearly conference in the summer. They call it their World Congress or something like that. But he said that.
And where do they have that? Hold that meeting?
Where they have it?
Yes.
At Hayden Lake, Idaho. And I went down there to exchange ideas with people, talk to people,
and usually ended up arguing with people that attended regularly, but I'd never joined, didn't want to join. I'm not a joiner of anything. I haven't for a long time.
How many meetings of the Aryan Nations did you attend?
Four, between three and five over a four-year period. I didn't actually, you know, it wasn't like Sunday services and all that. It was an annual conference thing.
Mr. Weaver, there was a very extended effort made by Alcohol, Firearms, and Tobacco to secure your services as an informant. And can you shed any light for this subcommittee on why the Alcohol, Firearms, and Tobacco Unit made such an extended effort to bring you into the informant status?
Actually, I can only speculate on that. We discussed that a little bit before. You'd have to ask Mr. Byerly and this guest Magisano or whatever his real name is, why? Because from what I heard later, they wanted me to infiltrate, inform on this certain person that I didn't know very well, but whenever we ran into each other at the Aryan Nations meetings, he would end up starting an argument with me, usually over religious issues, etc. So I couldn't figure out, to this day, it doesn't make any sense to me why they wanted me to try to go buddy up this guy and when we didn't get along that great anyway.
And what specifically did Alcohol, Firearms, and Tobacco do to try to bring you into their informant network?
Well,
so start, if you will, and briefly outline the series of events which led to the sale of the sawed-off shotguns for which you were indicted and tried. And as the court records show, you were acquitted after having made a defense of entrapment, which is a defense of law which exonerates an individual for conduct if the ideas are planted and instigated by law enforcement officials. But exactly what did happen factually with respect to the initial contacts and what you did as to the sale of those sawed-off shotguns?
What's that? Okay, when the very first meeting that I went to at Aryan Nations was in 1986, if I remember right, and I was introduced to this Gus Magisano by another man, and he became, well, we became acquainted, and he, for the next 3 years, you might say, befriended me. Is that the right way to say it? Acted as though he was my friend, and made contact with me several times and tried to talk me into doing illegal acts.
What illegal acts did he try to talk you into doing?
Well, specifically altering guns. He claimed to be a gun runner, making big bucks, had good business going. And I shied away from him all the time. I kept shying away from him, and about 3 years later, he caught me in a weak moment when I needed some money. And by this time, I just biggest mistake of my life, went ahead and did it. I sold him two guns. He showed me what he wanted me to do with them, and I said, yeah, I can do that. He offered me more money than has ever come out in testimony. But
how much money did he offer you?
He offered me $700 for two shotguns, which I had $250 in the guns, and I was going to make good profit. But even if I wouldn't have made that much profit, just to sell the guns, I'd have took it anyway, because I needed, you know, $700 is a lot of money out there at that time.
And after you sold him the sawed-off shotguns, what happened next?
I heard through the grapevine that this guy was an undercover agent or a federal agent, and I didn't know if I could believe the source that came from, but then I became real leery and wary. I had one more meeting with the guy, and I asked him about it, and he denied it vehemently. But after that, apparently he didn't trust me, and I didn't trust him anymore, and I had no more contact with him. Approximately 6 months later, I was approached by two ATF agents, Mr. Herb Byerly and Mr. Steve Gunderson. They approached me. They were in civilian clothes, and a Forest Service truck came up. Basically, what they said was that we're going to take you to court on 6 or 7 firearms violations if you don't join our team.
And did they amplify as to what they meant by, quote, joining our team?
I knew, and they knew I knew what they meant when I said...
What was your understanding as to what they meant by joining their team?
To go undercover for them.
Why were they so anxious to have you go undercover?
I can only speculate. You mean why they would want me to, or why they have people do it? I mean,
well, either way, as you have described it, and as we will have a further factual basis, the alcohol, firearms, and tobacco unit went to very elaborate procedures to get you to be an informant. And one of the things that this subcommittee wants to find out is what the purpose of that is and what alcohol, firearms, and tobacco are really doing in the use of the kind of resources, and we will get into that in some substantial detail, to have these prolonged contacts and then to have the sale of sawed-off shotguns and what turns out to be under a judicial decision to have been entrapment and improper law enforcement activities. But why target Randall Weaver in Boundary County with this kind of an elaborate process? What are they looking for, as you understand it?
I can only speculate as that, sir. I wish they'd tell me, to be honest with you. I hope that comes out sometime. I believe that undercover agents like Gus Magisano don't have a lot of courage, and he knew that, you know, he'd go pick on someone like me. He knows that I'm not going to come back and shoot his head off. He wasn't afraid of me.
Well, all right, moving ahead, Mr. Weaver, to a central part of this entire matter, as your statement outlines, and as we will go into greater detail, you were subsequently arrested, and there was an elaborate procedure for your arrest where they pretended to have a breakdown on the road, and when you were trying to help them, they took you into custody, which showed concern of theirs as to using that elaborate ruse instead of simply coming and serving a warrant of arrest. And we will try to find out what it was for law enforcement to undertake that kind of an unusual procedure. And then you did not respond to the process as you have described it. And it is a fairly common occurrence for people. It isn't unusual not to respond to a summons. When I was district attorney in Philadelphia, we had thousands outstanding, and we tried to serve them, and it's important for people to respond. But that raises the next question as to why, in this context, on this kind of a charge, did the law enforcement of the federal agencies mount such a substantial law enforcement effort, people coming to your home to take you into custody? That is a central question which this subcommittee will pursue in some depth. And obviously the real answers will have to come from alcohol, firearms, and tobacco as to why they proceeded as they did, and from the FBI as to why it proceeded as it did. But I think it is important for you to
tell this subcommittee, to the extent you can, even though it is speculation, why Mr. Weaver was the subject of this kind of law enforcement activity. That's the end of my time, Mr. Weaver. You're on your own time now.
Why they came after me, like the ATF even to start with, the way they did, you know, have you ever seen the bumper sticker, they will take my guns away from me when they pry it out of my cold dead fingers? I had one of those on at least one rig when I was up there, which a lot of gun advocates put on their bumper stickers. Most gun advocates out there, law-abiding citizens, don't really mean what that sticker says. If they believe that bumper sticker, and that's the way I was thinking mentally, then I can understand why they arrested me the way they did me. But as to why they targeted me and treated me the way they did, I would really like to find that out myself. I'd love to hear that.
Stay tuned, Senator Cole.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Weaver. Welcome here this morning. Just following up a little bit with beyond what Mr. Spector said, why you, and it will take several days for us to find out why you, if in fact it made any sense at all, but I'd like to pursue getting some kind of a description from you as to what kind of a person you are, what kind of a beliefs you hold, simply because it rounds out our picture of Mr. Weaver and his family. You talked about the Aryan Nation, and one of their beliefs, as you pointed out, is that the races should be separated. You said that you agree with that. Would you tell us why you agree with that, and I'm sure you've thought about it, how the races in this country would be separated?
Okay, sir, it can't happen. You know, the best you can do is go off in a remote area yourself, but my beliefs, you know, I hate being on the hot seat talking about my beliefs, political or religious, whatever. My family's been torn apart partially because of that. And I think my First Amendment rights allow me to keep those to myself. I'm not trying to be rude. My wife and I, if you knew us and followed us from the late 70s, even before that, early 70s, through 1992, you would see change after change after change after change. We studied and read, and we were, you might say, on a search for, quote, the truth.
Okay.
Our beliefs changed constantly.
All right. Well, just to continue that so we get, again, an understanding of where you were and where you perhaps are today. But the letters from your wife, Vicki, and statements made by you at the time that you were arrested indicated that your family would stand and fight to protect you. In fact, right after you surrendered to federal officials, you wrote a letter in which you stated, and I quote, "Sam and Vicki have always been ready and willing to do exactly what they did. What more could a man ask them to be able to say that under fire from ZOG, the Zionist occupied government, his family stuck together. By ZOG, the Zionist occupied government, I assume you meant the federal government. Could you explain to us what that was all about?"
That's a long question.
Is the federal government the Zionist occupied government?
Well, to be honest with you, sir,
what you said in your letter.
I don't know. That was part of our beliefs at one time. I'll have to know that if it is, they're giving me a fair shake now to come forward and tell, you know, bring the facts out about what the government did wrong. I have been wrong. I've said things that have been wrong. I've done things that were wrong. And I've paid a big, very heavy price for those things.
Okay. In an interview you gave to the Waterloo Courier in 1983, you were reported to have said that you were developing defense plans that included developing a, quote, 300-yard kill zone around your compound. What was the point of that?
That was a lie. That was a straight-up lie. That reporter at that time, when he left our house that day, he told Vicki and I, Vicki asked him, she said, well, what do you think? He came in there looking for a bunch of nuts, and when he left, he stood there at the door, and he says, I don't know whether to feel relieved or disappointed.
Okay. All right.
And he went and made up his own story.
All right. Another incident. Two neighbors who had bought land near your house apparently came to you once to inspect property markers. According to them, the neighbors, they were greeted by you and your son holding rifles. They told law enforcement officials later that you told them that you would shoot federal law enforcement officials who came on your property. According to them, you said, if they take me, I'll take some of them with me, and that's why we have guns.
That's not true.
All right. Another letter I have. Pardon me, do you want to elaborate on that?
Who said that anyway, did I ask?
This was reported, by Beverly, Ed and Beverly Torrance are apparently neighbors of yours, or were neighbors of yours.
Well, yeah, for a very short time they didn't,
All right. Well, I have another letter that was written by a neighbor of yours that appeared in the Bonner's Ferry Herald in April 1992. It was written by Ruth Rao. I'll just quote a few things. She says, I've remained silent long enough. I can't take another article or letter about innocent Randy Weaver and his nice family. I think it's time the truth be revealed. Yes, they have a religious front and they have deceived many with it, but there is no true substance to it. They are full of evil and lies. 2 years ago, we suffered several months of torment and harassment from the Weavers and their friends. Some of the crimes they committed against us were vandalism, theft, disturbing the peace, trespassing, and Randy Weaver threatened my husband's life. Randy once forced an innocent woman's car off the road and threatened her life in front of her small children. He supposedly did this because she had warned someone about what a crook that he was. I guess his belief in free speech doesn't always apply. Another thing I read is that they are not Nazi. Their children used to march back and forth by our house, wearing army jackets with Nazi armbands, carrying guns, shouting white power slogans, and doing the Hitler salute. They would stop occasionally to draw swastikas and write dirty words on the road. They have been raised to be little Nazi soldiers. This is Ruth Rao, not me. And she says, and she goes on to say that the Weavers, are reprehensible people according to her experiences with you as neighbor. Is Ruth Rao a person who's a reasonable person?
Not to me, she's not, but Ruth Rao upset my children several years before that by, how do you put it? She started it with my kids, and you know how if you're a certain neighbor and you get the neighbor kids upset with you and how they may come and want to soak your windows at Halloween? Well, she made my kids probably more upset than that. But what she has stated, besides being paid by the government to help them watch my family, didn't have, you know, one time she said that I shot over her house and things like that. It never happened. And most of what she said there, some of it I haven't even heard before.
All right. On March 5th, 1991, you sent a letter to the U.S. Marshal Service signed by every member of your family, in which you stated, and I quote, whether we live or whether we die, we will not obey your lawless government. What was that about?
Right. I can't remember the exact time that was written, but I believe it was written sometime after the government had lied and deceived me so many times, and my wife understood it, my children understood it, and my wife, but you know, she's a pretty hard-headed gal. She didn't like being lied and deceived, and we figured the government is not there to treat its citizens like that, and if they're going to do that, then apparently it's a lawless government, and that's what she meant by it.
Let's talk about our government just a minute. Now, as I think occurred, you finally did go to court. You were basically acquitted and exonerated. The laws of justice rolled on, and just in terms of what you were hauled into court for, you did all right by the American system of justice on that, didn't you?
Absolutely.
Had some new feelings about our system of justice today?
No, it worked for us very well. Yes, sir.
Do you perhaps wish that you had allowed it to work earlier?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. If I could change, believe me, I would, I'd give my life to have my son and wife back.
And had you allowed our system of justice to roll on earlier, as reprehensible as what occurred was, and we're here to talk about it, but had you allowed that system to roll on earlier, as most Americans do and are obligated to do, then justice would have been done by you. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, sir.
I thank you. I thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Senator Cole. Senator from Tennessee, Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Weaver, I think one of the questions that people initially ask is what has already been asked, and that is why you didn't come on down and go to trial to start with. You mentioned some things that I would just want to verify in painting the picture as to why you didn't, and why in turn it led to the confrontation and the tragedy that led to it. As I understand it, it's your position that in the first place the government deceived you by entrapping you,
yes,
by encouraging you to commit a crime.
Yes.
As we all know, the government can give you an opportunity to commit a crime, and if you commit it, that's your fault, and that's okay. But the government cannot encourage you to commit a crime when you do not otherwise have the propensity to do that. And what you're saying is over a period of 3 years?
Yes, sir.
They encourage you to commit a crime?
Yes, sir.
And that crime was to saw off the barrel of a shotgun?
Yes, sir.
Let me ask you parenthetically, in your mind, why didn't it occur to you that these people you were selling these guns to could have sawed those barrels off just as easily as you could?
Well, this Gus Magisano was not the type mechanically. Now, sawing the barrel off is easy, but if you wanted pistol grips, and I would challenge a lot of people in this room to make a nice, decent pistol grip out of a good butt of a shotgun and not wreck it and ruin the whole thing.
So it took some ability to do that.
That's right.
Second place, you say they deceived you as far as the arrest was concerned. They posed to be people in distress. You were driving along and you stopped your vehicle, got out into the snow to help what you thought were some people in distress there. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
So that's the way in which they chose to arrest you.
Yes, sir.
Then you went before the magistrate, and the magistrate misinformed you in terms of the consequences if you lost your case, right?
Yes, sir.
He basically said that if you lost, you'd have to reimburse the government for your court-appointed attorney.
Yes, sir.
And to you, I assume that meant that you'd lose the only asset that you had, which was what?
My property.
Your property and your cabin.
Yes, sir.
So you went away, in your mind, thinking that if you were convicted, you were wiped out.
That's right.
Did you later learn that the magistrate was incorrect about that?
Yes, I did.
Then the probation office sent you a letter misinforming you as to the correct file date.
Yes, sir.
It had originally been set for February the 19th, and you received a letter saying that it was really March the 20th. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And then you read in the paper, while holding that letter, presumably you read in the paper where the magistrate or the probation office was denying that they had sent you such a letter.
That's right.
Now, what did that cause you to think?
Just added on to everything he was thinking before. He couldn't trust anything that was going on.
So that was the background in which you found yourself in determining whether to come down,
yes, sir,
or not, and go to trial.
Yes, sir.
You know now that a couple of good lawyers and a good jury can cure a lot of ills, don't you?
Oh, yes, sir.
Then the question arises as to when your son got killed. Why did you stay in the cabin there that extra day there with your son lying in the shed there? You have this background that we've just discussed, then you have, in addition to that, your son having been killed. Did you know at that time that is immediately after your son had been killed, that it was law enforcement authorities who had shot him?
We've heard over the radio what had happened, their version of the story, which about blew our minds. But
what did you hear as to their version of the story?
They said that Kevin Harris and Randy Weaver had attacked U.S. Marshals or ambushed, whatever they want to say, from a truck while they were surveilling our property up there.
Was there any truck involved at all in this process?
No, sir. Yeah. They admitted that was false themselves later.
So in addition, you had that information from your radio.
Right.
That they were putting out information.
Never mentioned a thing about Sam.
And never acknowledged the fact that your son had been killed.
Yes, sir.
Would that have been something that they would have known? I mean, he was obviously lying there. Did you subsequently find out that they were in position to see the fact that he had been shot and killed?
Sir, we went down, Vicki and I went down within 30 to 40 minutes after the initial firing and picked him up off the road. And he couldn't have been more than maybe 60, 80 feet from where the marshals were hiding in the woods right there. Vicki and I didn't know they were still there. We figured they were gone, because when we walked down to pick him up, we figured they'd probably shoot us too. And so when we got there and we sit on the ground with Sam for a minute or two and before we started carrying him home.
And this was a 14-year-old boy?
Yes, sir.
Weighed less than 80 pounds?
About 80 pounds, 4'11". Still had the voice of a kid. He hadn't matured yet.
Let me ask you about these rules of engagement. You've heard, obviously, about all that, lived with that for a long time. There's controversy about that. I understand from reading the record that you and your children, too, at least your older children, every time you went out of the cabin, you were armed in one fashion or another. Is that correct?
Well, we've done that for several years.
Why was that?
In the mountains, mountain kids, a lot of them, they will get a gun and a dog, like the city kids get a basketball and a bicycle. My children, I taught them, when they turned 8 years old, I taught them all how to use BB guns safely, how to use the sights, and they used the BB gun for 2 years and could practice with it whenever they wanted. When they turned 10, then they could go to like a 22 rifle or whatever, and they could progress in the use of firearms. And in out in that area, we were right in the middle of grizzly territory, mountain lions, moose, they're very dangerous animals. I always taught my kids, I always told them, I said, if a moose or a bear or anything acts like he wants to give you a hard time, never shoot him, because they'd never probably be able to kill him with what they had, but fire in the air, and the sound many times will scare the animal away, where if they was to shoot and wound the animal, he might just continue.
Did your wife also go armed when she left the cabin up there for the same reasons?
Sometimes, not very often. My wife actually didn't like to shoot that much.
But she sometimes would?
Sometimes, yeah, she'd go armed for the same reason.
In fact, when she was killed, was she armed at that time? She have a handgun on her at that time?
She had a 380 semi-automatic pistol that was right down here on her side under her sweater, which I didn't know she had it on until I got her into the cabin.